listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.
Today we welcome a very special guest, an Australian author who has written more than 200 books and won more than 60 awards both in Australia and internationally. Senior Australian of the Year in 2015, Australian Laureate 2014-15 and patron of literacy programs across Australia. She's also studied over 400 wombats and describes herself as an Australian author, ecologist, historian, dyslexic and honorary wombat. Welcome, Jackie French.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to get to talk to you this morning, Jackie. Now, I'm going to lead off a little bit differently from the books. I need to start with food.
What's a good idea?
I went browsing your website in the preparation for this, and I found whenever I've spoken to authors, there is a very strong link between authors and food, and your website takes that to an absolute maximum level.
I don't think that's a coincidence. I've actually found that authors tend to create. And when you create one thing, like books, your creativity tends to spill into other areas. And for many authors, that is food. It is an extraordinary proportion of authors who are actually very eager and incredibly good cooks. Probably all the rest of them are incredibly discerning eaters because, again, this is what you put into your books. A good author really takes note of the world around them, the smells, the tastes, the feel, the people, the stories. And so I don't think it's a coincidence. I think someone who was, shall we say, sort of mentally or taste bud dead probably would not be a good author, or being expected to be a good author.
Yeah, I think for me, and I love food and cooking and all of those sorts of things, and I do another podcast related to food and cooking and the pursuit of it, and I find it, again, it's creative outlet and also a way to relax as well. Is that something you think as well that comes into the cooking? Because looking at your recipes, the detail, especially when you go down things like the baking, I'm a big fan of baking and the array of goods baked. That's a good question, yeah.
Yes, look, for me there's another thing as well. First of all, it's exactly the same method that I use with creating books. I love creating new recipes. Partly that's accidental because I had to leave home at 15. I had quite a few years, in fact even decades, where if I didn't grow it, I didn't eat it. So my cooking very much evolved as, okay, what have we got that is available and what can I cook from it? So right from the beginning, I was a cook who, rather than following recipes, was evolving recipes. And it's exactly the same process that I follow with a book. You take diverse ingredients, you work out the threads between them, you actually knit different threads between them, you bring them together, and then you either end up with a different kind of muffin or a book. So it's relaxation in a sense, but it's also got the same kind of focus that I would use when I create a book. But I think there's another part for me which is genetic. I don't just love cooking. I love feeding people. I don't so much cook as cater. We've just had 11 people staying with us and it has been wonderful because I have got to feed a lot of people, including other people calling in. And it's a gene in our family. My niece has got it. My grandmother had it. My great-grandmother and my great-great-grandmother had it. It certainly sips people in our family. There's just one, I think, per generation that actually gets the gene. And it really is the more people we are feeding, the happier that we are.
that's something in my family too, which is one of the reasons I think why I connected so strongly. And I obviously a lot of that comes because of that amazing garden of yours too. How good is it to go and get that produce and all that stuff to be able to just create with as you need to?
Look, I'd say it's good, but again, as I really started doing it when I was 17, which was a long time ago, I really don't know any other way of doing it. I find supermarkets quite bewildering, particularly as I've got absolutely no idea of the quality of food there. So if I walk through a supermarket, I can't actually look at a piece of fruit or a vegetable and know this is going to be in its prime, it's really going to taste strongly. The few times I do cook away from home with bought ingredients, it just doesn't work particularly well because I expect to use a carrot and actually have an incredibly strong sweet flavour, and they don't. They're fairly tasteless. Tomatoes are almost completely tasteless.
They're very bland, yes.
Yes, and so I think there's also not a coincidence that the recipes Australians are using are increasingly strongly flavoured, that we're using Thai, Indian, other spices, Middle Eastern spices, to cover up the fact that our ingredients no longer actually taste of something. Ironically, some of my favourite foods and what I eat mostly are actually very, very plain ones. I eat a lot of fruit, I eat a lot of vegetables, often served with just a small amount of salsa or something like that. But they're not actually strongly spiced or even strongly herbed because they've got very, very distinct flavours of their own. But when I go out, I've learned that no, choose something that has flavour added to it.
Yeah, it's the natural taste of the fruit as well and the produce. And the last thing on that, one of the things you do talk about on your website when you talk about the gardening is something that, again, as a historian, I've sort of got a bit of a passion for, which is the move away from that traditional colonial style of gardening and the way that you plant food and the way that you grow food, which was always incorrect for conditions. You know, the idea of bringing British crop and planting British crop in Australian soil with Australian heat and Australian temperatures, that sort of way. I like the fact that you sort of talk about needing to find new ways and more ways that are more appropriate for conditions. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yes. Again, that was partly serendipity. Again, because of poverty, I had to not just grow my food, but use the things that grew around here. And I was extraordinarily lucky at 15 to be taken under the wing of people like Maureen Watson, Kath Walker, now known as Utro of the Nununkle, etc., who didn't care about the colour of my skin. They just decided we needed a grounding. We needed adoption by the Nununkle to give us a feeling of place and belonging. When I came to the valley where I live now, there were people who knew how to harvest the bush, so that certainly in the early days before the fruit trees were bearing, etc., a lot of what I used came from the bush, whether it was building materials. I mean, a large part of my house was built from material on the property. So partly by serendipity, partly by choice, partly by absolute fascination, partly by poverty, I ended up using the techniques that have been used for tens of thousands of years or hundreds of years and relying on them. For the decade here that I lived without electric power before I got enough solar panels to have light at night, again, I was making my own candles, I was making slushy lamps, etc. I was using stringy bark to make string and rope and nets. I was using stringy bark to make the roof of my first dummy, etc., and a couple of other structures as well, learning the best time, because there is just one here, one very, very good time to actually cut the stringy bark. Any other time, it just doesn't really work as well. So without meaning to, I certainly wasn't doing it as research for books, but by the time I started to make a living as a writer, I did have a couple of decades of knowledge of how to do things. And also too, because of being broke, I'd been looking out medieval texts on actually how to make things like candles, etc., or soap. I've been looking out colonial documents, and I've certainly been talking to some of the very elderly people around here, and I can't emphasize that enough. I come from a family of storytellers, particularly my grandmother, my great-grandmother, who we actually lived with for my first 3 years. But with them, they told stories of their lives when they were young, but also they told me the stories that their grandmothers and great-grandmothers had told them about when they were young, or their great-grandmothers or grandmothers had told them. So just in the stories that I was told on those very hot or very wet days when you need to keep the kid quiet, I was getting the stories of my family going back for hundreds of years. It meant that I always grew up with this feeling of extraordinary social continuity, never locked into this little box of the present, but always knowing that the present was just this second where we're standing now, linked to the past and, for that matter, linked to the future as well. So when I started writing, I did know how people lived, how people talked. I had this incredible repertoire of true stories. Though there's a little bit of a proviso there. The stories great-grandma told me were, I'm pretty sure, actually quite accurate. Grandma did have a tendency to certainly tell the truth, but not quite the whole truth. For example, one of the stories which I loved was how great-great-grandma danced with a bushranger, Ben Hall. They were having a ball at the family property. He and his gang burst in. Everyone screamed, etc., etc. But she just laughed and went up to Ben Hall and said, "Look, you're spoiling a perfect good party. Why don't you put your pistols away and join in?" And the first person he danced with was my great-great-grandmother, who was only 12 years old at the time. And the descriptions of that, but the fact that they had an orchestra dance in Sydney, the ballroom floor was polished, etc., etc., the women in their jewels. And as a child, I accepted that utterly. In my early 20s, I began to think, hey, wait a minute. Certainly, they were fairly comfortable, but they were not wealthy. What's all of this about an orchestra dance in Sydney and the ballroom floor polished and jewels? That simply wasn't the strata of society they moved in. And for a while, I actually thought, no, this can't be right. And then, quite accidentally, I found an advertisement in an old Golden Post for the Horse and Jockey Inn. And the bit that Grandma hadn't told me was that, actually, there's a whole range of scandals I won't go into now. The family property actually had been run down. My great-great-great-grandfather possibly had been murdered by his oldest son, but we won't go into that. But unusually, the property then went to my great-great-grandmother. It was a horse stud, and she turned it into the Horse and Jockey Inn. And they had what were known as subscription balls. You actually paid to go to the ball, and then the day afterwards, there would be horse races with very, very scandalously, including horse races for female jockeys, and, of course, a really, really good way to sell your horses. And within 10 years, in fact, she turned the family fortunes around. Every one of those kids went off with a very, very substantial amount of money to buy a good farm, a couple of hotels, stores, etc. They made a lot of money doing it. So I now think that story was absolutely true, but not the whole truth. The ballroom floor was polished, but my ancestor was actually there with aprons on, serving the food rather than dancing. That was just a bit that Grandma missed out.
Again, the best storytellers, as you well know, pick and choose.
Oh, yes,
we should also talk about books.
Too much fun,
but I don't have any time.
Okay, fine.
Well, I'm going to actually do a food book segue.
Oh,
from what I've noticed from reading a lot of your books, Jackie, there is a definite motif of cheese. Ophelia is obsessed by cheese in Ophelia, Queen of Denmark. Hekia, is that how I'm saying Hekia from
Raymond
Booking?
Yes.
Good. That's how I said it in my head when I read the book. She makes cheese, and Sophie's father in the Lily series eats cheese in his office. So what is the motif of cheese in your novels, Jackie? Is it a secret message to readers?
Well, look, yes, I am very fond of cheese. But one cheese also, too, was a desperately socially important food until recently with refrigeration. It was one of the few foods that would keep not just for years, but even for decades. And in fact, in peat bogs now, archaeologists are still digging up kegs of salted butter, etc., which are hundreds or even 1,000 years old. They're still, well, edible in a sense. but yes, that was actually how it was preserved. In ancient Irish, Scottish, or Gaelic lore, if a marriage broke up, a woman owned the produce of the dairy. If there were to be divorced, etc., the woman always took the dairy products with her. And so that wasn't just this year's cheeses. This would have been cheeses made over decades. With Ophelia, to the modern era, yes, a preoccupation with cheese may seem slightly odd, but back then in Denmark, that really was the sign of a secure household or a secure country. That in a bad winter, animals might die, etc., you might have sieges. But if you had a good storeroom full of cheeses, you had food which literally would keep you for decades. And that really was the secure part of a family's wealth in the days when there really wasn't much banking because usury, charging interest was illegal. So that the main form of investment, the main form of security was cheese. And also for Sophie's father as well. His comfort food, because he did grow up in a poor English family and then New Zealand. His comfort food as a very young man would have been cheese rather than meat. Meat would have been something eaten only on a very, very special occasion. But the real comfort food, there's so many references to cheese, and also too because we don't think of Roggedo's fasts these days, but there were quite a lot of them where you were only allowed to eat what was called white food, i.e. cheese or fish. You weren't allowed to eat meat. And over and over, when you read old letters or even ancient letters from students at Oxford writing back to their mothers, there's one wonderful one talking about toasted cheese. And toasted cheese wasn't what we think of as a toasted cheese sandwich. It was a hunk of cheese that you would actually put on your knife and you would just hold it over the fire just so it's outside sort of melted and bubbled a little bit. And then you would actually eat your, literally, just toasted cheese with nothing else. In today's society, we've really forgotten the extraordinary social importance of cheese in European history. I have to emphasise this is European, certainly not the case in Asia, the Middle East, Africa, etc., or the islands. This was a very, very European tradition, but wherever you had cows. And remember too that the Indo-Europeans were cow herders. That's where they came from. They came bringing their herds of cows. So again, even trapping as nomads, you had your cheeses. You would put your, well, I use saddlebags with inverted commas. They were, in fact, there's an indigenous tradition using exactly the same thing. You very carefully gut an animal so that you, there's only a small gap at either end which can be tied up with twine. And that can be filled with liquid. It's fairly waterproof, though a little bit seeps out. And if you use that as a saddlebag, it means by the end of the day, you've got yogurt or you've got curds and whey. And if you let it drain for longer, you end up with cheese. And the longer it drains, the harder and longer lasting and more strongly flavoured your cheese is going to be. So our ancestors, tens of thousands of years ago, if they came from Europe, again, if they were nomads, it would have been cheese. Cheese and milk were just extraordinarily important.
And ginger, they came on Viking ships as well. They used it as trade, so it is a really important resource.
Oh, yes, yes, and enormously. And again, once you'd actually got your good cheese, you could cover it with wax. And as I said, a good cheese will last for many, many decades. And possibly even longer for that if it's stored in something like a bog.
What I find really impressive about your career, Jackie, and I don't think many authors have actually achieved this, is how broad your audience is. My five-year-old, he doesn't quite understand what we do, but he does ask, oh, who are you talking today, Mum, with the microphone? And I said, oh, Jackie French. And he immediately made a connection to the Wombat Picture Book. When I told my mother, who is 60 years old, I think she's very similar age to what you are, she said she's a former librarian and she was really interested in the historical fiction and mentioned Hitler's daughter. And we're both educators, and so a lot of my colleagues have said, oh, it's a Lumbergh country, or Waltz for Matilda, or Missing You, Love, Sarah, A Rose for Anzac Boys. And I just think everyone I spoke to had their favourite Jackie French book from 5 years old to 65 years old. Did you think your intention to cover such a broad range of audience, or did this just happen accidentally for you?
Sort of. When I wrote my first book, Rainstones, I didn't intend it as a children's book. It just had a young protagonist. And I hadn't realised, of course, the young protagonist, it would automatically be seen as a book for children. I just wrote it as a story. And it did happen to have a young girl, a 12-year-old, at the centre of it. With most of my books, I don't even really think about them as being for a particular age group, except insofar as the protagonist will be this age or that age. I don't militate my language in any way for young people or if I'm writing for adults. I think that's one of the worst things you can do for a child is use simple language. I just had my grandchildren staying here and was very, very careful, as I always am, to use exactly the same language, complexity of ideas, complexity of language that I would with an adult. Now, one of them is 2, one of them is 4, and they had, well, not only had no problems whatsoever, they were really interested, a new word, a new concept. This is exciting. The job of a child is to learn how to be an adult. So, yes, we shouldn't restrict the complexity of our things. We shouldn't reduce the complexity of our language. Certainly not change the vocabulary that we use when we write for kids. Kids need this. This is what they need and also what they absolutely love. But the variation in, well, picture books, chapter books, et cetera, writing about whether they're fluffy animals, that comes into the wombat isn't terribly fluffy, or books for adults like Miss Lily. I find it odd that everyone doesn't do it. And increasingly now, we are seeing that authors are beginning to write books for different age groups and not feel that they have to be categorised. But this certainly was the case, I think about 10 years ago when I wrote, in fact, it was about then that I wrote Miss Lily, HarperCollins didn't want to bring it out because they thought that an adult book, particularly one that had those themes, would mean that it would cut into my younger readership. People would not be comfortable with writing about, well, adult or young adult. And again, I really don't see much difference between young adult and adult, except that in young adult, again, like Miss Lily, you have a younger adult as a protagonist. So as the series goes by, Sophie will grow older. But then in each book too, there will be a younger person as well to keep it young adult as well as adult. But no, there was this real feeling that you had to stick to one age group. If you're a kid's author, you had to stay a kid's author. If you're an adult author, you had to stay an adult author. And you should only write in one genre. There was even discussion of my writing books using pseudonyms because I wanted to write for different age groups. Again, that's now changed. People are getting more comfortable with the idea of authors writing in different genres. But that is actually fairly recent. But all of us who love books tend to read more than one genre. Certainly if we've got kids, we will read books to our children. I find it as odd thinking that I'd only write in one genre or for one age group as if I'd stick just to one food group or just one kind of food. We all read different kinds of books. So why on earth only write one kind of book? But it's also probably the reason why I've written so many books. I couldn't write more than one Miss Lily or Matilda book, for example, a year. I just couldn't. My brain wouldn't do it. But writing different kinds of books is entirely different. My brain has a break. And I do very much alternate the kind of books that I write. I've just finished the next Matilda book. And in fact, it's in its final stage of editing. The only problem with that was 2 days ago I realised I'd really got it wrong. There was always something niggling with me. The book was not as compelling as it should be. There was something wrong, and 2 days ago I finally worked out what it was. And thank goodness for understanding editors, because I emailed and said, look, I'm sorry, I know it's on its final, what's that, but I need to make this major change. And yes, they've agreed. And in fact, yes, had the aha moment. Yes. This is what is really going to really give the book a lot more depth and richness and tension doing this. But having, I thought, finished that book, I then went on to a picture book text, which was just fun, just absolute ridiculous. Really ridiculous fun. And I'm now writing a piece of short fiction. It will probably only be about 36 to 40,000 words, much younger protagonist, much more action, far fewer. Well, there are always fairly rich themes in the books. So yes, very deliberately, I go from one kind of writing to another, to another, to another. And I do need that break. And I think if I hadn't had the break, writing the picture book and then writing this book, my brain wouldn't have been free to subconsciously brood on what was wrong with the larger book and work out, no, this is how it needs to be completely retweaked.
And I think the other thing too with keeping to one genre is that genres never keep within one genre.
Mm.
I mean, one of the examples is, for example, Macbeth and Son. And, you know, the story of Macbeth, the Shakespeare telling of it versus the, and again, I'm a historian, that's my background, but the actual historical accuracy behind the story of Macbeth and Duncan and Malcolm and Banquo and all those sorts of of audience coming into it. And that's something you've addressed a lot with regards to things like writing history for kids. I read the article on your website with great interest. And I really enjoyed the fact that you wrote down the past wasn't like today. People thought in different ways, acted for different reasons. It's important that kids realise this too. So I like the idea that, and that's not about, as you said, it's not about teaching people, if we don't know our past, we're doomed to repeat it. It's about teaching context and about understanding context of action rather than oh, look, it's just looking back and don't do this again. It's why and the rationale behind it. And that's an important thing, I think, in teaching history that I've seen with students. It's not about the recounting of events as such. It's the understanding of the process to get to the event. And I like the fact that when you talk about writing history for children, you specifically say don't abandon the truth. In fact, it's one of the more important things. Explain how it gets there.
Yes. In Macbeth and Son, and to a greater extent in Third Witch, I've used Macbeth as one of the great examples of historical propaganda, mm-hmm. which has now more or less become history. I mean, the real Macbeth wasn't even a king in the way mm-hmm. that we think of kings. He was elected. He was elected by the thanes, who themselves had been elected, and by the bishops, who again had been elected. He could be unelected at any time. I first came across the real Macbeth in one of the Icelandic sagas, mm-hmm. where he was described as this ruddy face, one of the best kings, most Christian kings, etc. Lady Macbeth did in fact rule the Scotland while Macbeth went on pilgrimage to Rome. She mm-hmm. was known as a woman of calm, of deep education. She founded schools, etc., etc. Women could be kings back then, though they often weren't. There was a very, very deliberate retelling of the story of Macbeth, because his period of history was really when the English were coming up with the divine right of kings. Mm-hmm. The idea of an elected king was something that people had to forget very, very quickly. And so,
the line in Macbeth is the where they show Banquo and the your issue and there and theirs and theirs, which is deliberately designed for the king at the time, which Shakespeare was writing for.
Yes, yes. After Macbeth, kings were kingship actually was inherited and inherited by men. But in Macbeth's time, even though women very rarely did become a thane, they could. It was a position that was voted on. Women had a much, much stronger role. But Macbeth had to be made a villain. But I think there was also another reason for the writing of Macbeth, if you look at the timing. Shakespeare wrote magnificent roles for women. Juliet is possibly the first play, apart from the ancient Greek ones where in fact men played the roles anyway. It's one of the first plays in European literature where all of the action hinges on a woman, a girl, a young girl. And of course that role had to be played by a young boy, and you have to be a very, very good actor indeed to be able to carry a play like that. But Shakespeare was writing then in the last years of the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, who would obviously be extremely happy to see very, very strong female roles. But then James I came to the throne. Now, James was, to put it very bluntly, a nutcase. He hated women in power. He believed deeply in witches. He even wrote a book outlining all sorts of useful tortures to actually get witches to confess. I mean, he really hated women. And yeah. I think Shakespeare probably had to do some very, very fast backpedaling. Here he was, noted for plays like Romeo and Juliet, Portia, etc., Merchant of Venice. He had to do something to show the king, his patron, that he was a right-thinking person. And my feeling is that he created Macbeth using every bit of his skills, and Macbeth is the most extraordinary, wonderful play, using every bit of his skill to show what happens when a woman takes over power or is in a position of power. She goes mad like Lady Macbeth does. She cannot take it. She becomes evil, etc. All her goodness is perverted, bringing the witches into it, etc., etc. This was Shakespeare, I think, doing the best he possibly could to create exactly the kind of lie and social madness that was going to appeal to the king. And one of the tragedies is that it's been accepted as history.
And it's one of those things where this is why it's so important when you write history, especially for children, is that you keep the information accurate, keep the information as truthful as possible. As you said, one of the main roles with children is that you're learning how to be an adult. And you know, potentially a large element of what we see today in other areas comes from people not really worrying about where the actual truth lies in information in foundation times.
Yes, I think the word "crucify" that we've all got so used to in the last year really exemplifies where our society is at the moment, where an extraordinary amount of money goes into what is euphemistically known as public relations, which could also be known as a lie. It's one thing of presenting a product in the best possible light, but we're getting more and more accustomed to lies. The things that our politicians say, a lot of it, they are lying, and they know they are lying, and yet it is accepted. And I found it horrendous in the last decade, seeing how society is more and more accepting of knowing that people in authority have actually lied to them. Not told the entire truth, that's fine, but actually told what they know are falsehoods, not just for the security of the country, because yes, occasionally that might be necessary, but literally for their own personal or unnatural advantage. Lying is becoming acceptable, but the problem is every time we accept a lie, the bonds that hold our society together become frayed. If you think about it, it is enormously easy to kill your neighbour. Our police forces, our security forces, if human beings really didn't get on with each other and didn't cooperate, our armies, our police forces, our security forces would not be enough to stop it. Society operates because at a very deep level, humans help each other, cooperate with each other and want to get on with each other. But the more we accept lies as an everyday thing, I think all of those bonds get more and more fragile. So kids need to be taught, one, that the truth matters, but also how do you find the truth? It was an enormous revelation to me, particularly looking at some of Australian colonial history. I'd grown up thinking that, yes, an historical document must be true. You get a letter from Governor Phillip or something like that, or from MacArthur. Right, I found out what happened back then. Oh, yes, here it is. And then suddenly realising, hey, wait a minute, they lied. They were actually lying. But they were lying, actually, particularly, I think, in the case of Phillip, for a very good reason. He was desperately trying to get the things that the colony needed from the Home Office in Britain, who really regarded the colony at the end of the world as very small beer indeed. Tench, in his book, Watson Tench, he obviously wanted the bestseller, and he got the bestseller. So again, he's playing up the drama. Now, Tench, in fact, interestingly, I don't think he lied, but he did play up the drama. Tench actually doesn't say we starved. Tench talks about the spectre of starvation, the worry about starvation. And yes, it's true. I think the colony was desperately worried that they were starving. But if you look at the medical records, you find, in fact, they were better fed than they would have been in England. There was no starvation, apart from two people with mental problems, which we won't go into. Women who had never been able to bear children were bearing children. There was an extraordinarily high birth rate. The colony simply did not starve, but they were scared of starving. And that I find fascinating because, in fact, it was almost a, an hysteria gripping the colony. They were isolated. They'd certainly run out of major things like flour, wine, etc., though they still did have some black powder things for that fuel for their muskets. A lot of it had been damaged by time and by water, so that if they had been attacked by the Gadigals or the French, etc., they almost certainly would not be able to defend themselves, that they would have been wiped out. So, look, they had every reason to be terrified. So, look, there was certainly terror, but there wasn't starvation. So history is a very good place to let kids roam, looking at historical lies, looking at good and evil, looking at what you can do and what you can't do, because the politics is over. It's really what I've done in Hitler's Daughter, Pennies for Hitler, Goodbye, Mr. Hitler. Apart from some rather peculiar people who think Hitler was a hero still, right-thinking people know, look, we've established this was evil. This was pure evil. This was insanity. It was a social insanity. This was wrong. And therefore, it's something which no one needs to debate. You can present this as actually good and evil without us having to discuss the politics as we would if I set those stories today. So history is a safe place for kids to look at good and evil, at really hard things. And also, of course, it's over. The good guys have won. We're safe. You can write about the tsunami, you can write about the volcanic explosion, write about the Viking attacks, you can write about the Holocaust. And kids will know this is safely in the past. I don't have to worry about it this afternoon. Only the issues. It is just a story now.
That's a great point. And some of my favourite books of yours are where you have that really strong female protagonist, because I think in history, as you've mentioned in your books, women's voices are often lost, forgotten in history, or they're silent. And your Shakespeare series, I Am Juliet, Ophelia and Third Witch, really show that strong female voice, as well as a book I loved, They Came on Viking Ships. But one of my favourite quotes from Third Witch was, he did not know my lady, nor me, nor Mistress Margaret, or Mistress Ruth, or Mam, or Agnes. Who did he think laid out the dead, tended the dying, or brought children into the world with love and pain? Not men. So it seems to be not only the silent voices, but how underestimated women were in history.
Yes, I think women have been deliberately left out. But again, I'm probably showing my age. I grew up at a time when women were pretty powerless. One of the battles my mother fought was in a newspaper where a woman would never be given her own name. She'd be known as Mrs. John Smith, not Mrs. Barbara Smith. She not only took her husband's name in public, she took his Christian name as well. There were subjects that girls were not allowed to study. Girls were barred from most of the professions and most of the apprenticeships. A married woman was not allowed to be a teacher or a librarian or a nurse. Women had to quit on their marriage. And women's wages weren't enough to live on. The first job I had leaving school and between school and university I worked 7 days a week with overtime on every day, and I got $19.50 a week. A man doing exactly the same job with the same amount of overtime got $166 a week. And $19.50 a week was not really enough to live on. I survived because I was working as a chambermaid. The woman in the kitchen gave me these enormous breakfasts every day. If I hadn't had that, well, in fact, looking at photographs on my student card, I'm almost skeleton-like. It really was not enough to live on. My English teacher told me a couple of years ago a story which I didn't know, and she was still furious about it, that the school I went to, the girls and boys were educated with Brisbane State High, so were educated differently in different classes, even though it was the same school. And it was only in the last 2 years where the top girls and boys would be taught in the same class, but only the very best of them. And apparently, I got the history prize and the general proficiency prize, but I hadn't known that I was supposed to get the English prize. And she said, look, everyone agreed that overwhelmingly I should get it. But there was a boy who hadn't gotten the award, and she was still furious about the fact that everyone except her thought that it would be incredibly bad for this boy's ego and self-image if he would be beaten by a girl.
Wow.
And so they gave it to him even though he was by no means the person who should have got it, but simply because they really thought a girl should not be winning awards.
And it's incredible when you say these things, because you think time has changed, and when you're talking about the wage gap and you're talking about masculinity, so many things are still the same, and that patriarchy still exists in
us. And I try to add the context and explanation for a lot of boys at the school that I'm at in terms of the history of those sorts of things, and they struggle to see it. They really struggle to see it. I mean, it's a lot better than it was with them, but it's still there.
And that's why your books are so important. I mean, my favourite image in the book, they came on Viking ships, I just find that such a powerful novel, is the heavily pregnant woman and the young girl running into battle because the men have turned away. And I just find that the most powerful image, because if women, especially when they need to protect their children or their future children, they will go into battle and they'll just do it, you know, and I love that image.
That actually isn't fictional, or if it's fiction, it's not mine. It's historical.
I read the Knights
of the End. That's actually in the Icelandic sagas. There's the two completely different versions of what happened in that battle, and they're separated by about 200 years. And again, the latter one, which makes Freydis, a bit like Lady Macbeth, again was written while women were being rewritten to show this is what happens when women get power. They actually go mad and they are evil. We forget how recently women were very, very strongly suppressed. I was the first year where a married woman could become a permanent public servant. And I very carefully, because I was married then, I very carefully didn't tick the box whether I was married or not in case they changed the law. We had a mortgage. I couldn't afford to lose the job. And so I didn't want any proof that I actually was married in case the regulation was changed and women lost their job again. But we forget, I mean, I'm a baby boomer, and the men who are pretty much in control now are my age, or a bit younger or a bit older. In other words, these are men who grew up as boys, being the ones who were given the English prize because they were boys, not because they deserved to get it. They grew up thinking that women were there to be their secretaries, their research assistants, but the credit would automatically go to the man. Women were there to help, and that was it. but the men were the real people and the women were the helpers. So, yes, of course we've still got misogyny, but if you look at the age group, remember these are men who grew up with that.
That's a great point.
Yeah. When I look at my son and his wife, my stepdaughters and their husbands, in my generation, you and Lucky, if a man would help with the housework, and the emphasis there is help, you ask them to do something and they will do it. But in their generation, looking at them actually cooking together, doing things together, just automatically dividing the household work, the childcare, et cetera, et cetera. It's something they don't have to negotiate. It's something they don't have to argue. They just automatically do it. So I think this is misogyny, which hopefully will pass away as my generation's grasp on power goes away.
It's an interesting time. Because I have a young son and I find that there is that real, you know, we're trying to be really equal in our household, but then, like you say, our leaders are not, and they get these subliminal messages still, even though you're trying to, you know, make them, you know, show them a different way, there is still those subliminal messages in society. My 5-year-old picks them up, you know.
Yes, look, I don't think it's going to be solved in one generation, but we do need to remember that it was so appalling as recently as 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Then when we're talking about bishops, archbishops, or for that matter, prime ministers, we are still talking about blokes who grew up in an incredibly male chauvinist society where men had all the power, all the voices, and women were even barred from a heck of a lot of education and professions. So it is going to take a few generations, but we do need to make the point in books, but one of the other things in books too, by showing that things have changed, I think gives kids hope. If you talk to kids, most of them are actually scared of the future. They're scared of climate change, they're scared of nuclear war, they're scared of economically not getting jobs, etc. And these are actually quite valid fears. These are things that's sensible to be worried about. But I think it's also important to give kids the confidence of knowing that humans are good at challenges. It's no accident that most of my books are at times of challenge. In Pharaoh with climate change, books set in war, times of social disruption, even times like the Depression, etc. They show people having to face challenges, but then cooperatively, with cooperation and with determination, meeting those challenges and succeeding. Every one of us is descended from people who survived far worse climate change than even our great-grandchildren are going to face with the ice ages. We are descended from the people who survived ice ages. We know that because if our ancestors hadn't survived, we wouldn't be here. We're descended from the people who have survived an extraordinary number of wars and plagues and social disruptions and climate change. Our ancestors were either very good at hiding, running fast, or being very, very nice people, able to smile and say, we may not be able to share the same language, but please don't kill me. I'm just passing through. I need to be here. Or we're heroes and we're very good at meeting those challenges. We're descended from survivors. And showing kids the challenges of the past and how humans faced them and succeeded, I think gives them confidence to know that, yes, we can't promise them a perfect future. We can't, I'd love to do that, but we can't. History shows us that, yes, mostly tomorrow will be like today, but one day it won't be. But be concerned about that, but don't be scared. Humans are very, very good at challenges. And in fact, when humans are challenged, we're really at our best. If you look at the way we reacted to 2003 bushfires, the 2011 floods, etc., etc., when humans are challenged, we are capable of the greatest generosity, empathy, and cooperation. We're good at challenges. The one thing we're not very good at is boredom. And I think that is a far greater danger for today's youth than the challenges they're going to face. Boredom where you retreat into computer games, or boredom where you form gangs, just basically to get a bit of an adrenaline rush because you don't have anything else, don't know any other way of actually bonding together, getting that not just adrenaline rush, but that feeling of actually being a cohesive group, doing things together. Boredom is an extraordinary threat for today's youth. And again,
I love that in your The Rights of the Child reader on your website. And number four is, every child has the right to say, this book is boring, may I have another?
I realised that talking to a mob of kids who I'd been told were illiterate and unable to write an essay. By the time we'd actually had 2 hours together, they decided to get up their lunchtime to keep working on it. They could write an essay. But one of the great problems was they were supposed to be writing about Romeo and Juliet. And while all of them actually liked the story, as seen in a movie, they all thought that there were just too many words, which spoiled it. And giving them the freedom to say, there are too many words, this should be cut out, this should be cut out, this doesn't work, this doesn't work. Once they had the freedom to criticise it and say, we don't like it because, they started having fun. Where so often kids are told, this is a brilliant book, you will actually write an essay about why this is a brilliant book, you will find 6 examples of beautiful imagery in this, etc., etc. Kids need to be given... Well, certainly kids need to be given a choice of the books they study, if possible. But there are also times where the whole class needs to study the one book so you can actually all discuss it. But kids need to be given the freedom to say, this is not a good book, or it could be a good book. Other people may like it, but I believe it fails because this. Once you give kids the freedom to criticise and say why it doesn't work, okay, you hate this book? Right, substantiate it. Why do you hate this book?
That's something that I believe strongly into through teaching when I do history classes. One of my first sentences that I say to a class is, what I want you to do when I give you something on history is feel free to say to me, that's wrong. But the next words out of your mouth need to be, and this is why. Follow my explanation.
Well, critical thinking.
And again, because that's what, as you said before, the role of being a child, one of them is to learn how to be an adult and think critically. And too often, I think at times, part of education, sometimes you just shut people down. That's not the right answer. Whereas it's flesh it out.
I've always loved history as stories. I never thought of it as a discipline until... Marty Sullivan, he ended up becoming professor of history, but he was actually just teaching for a few years while he did his PhD. And I remember the first day he appeared in our class, he actually bounded into the classroom, and his first words were, revolutions do not happen when times are bad. Revolutions happen when things get slightly better and people have hope. And then he looked around us and said, discussed with relevance to the French Revolution. And suddenly I was thinking, no, this isn't just stuff I have to learn. This is stuff I actually have to analyse and work out. And there are people in it, people with human motivations. And I was hooked. It was that one, couple of sentences from Marty Sullivan that actually turned me into a historian and probably a writer as well. History teaches us what a heck of a lot of power.
And again, it's something that I love that moment when you get, much like with any teacher, of course, but with history in particular, when you get that student with hooks into that critical analysis and this idea of it's not just about remembering dates. It's about understanding people, it's about understanding society. From that sort of bent as well, from a historian's perspective, is there any era that you haven't written about yet that you really want to explore?
Not an era as such, because increasingly, in fact, I have written about a lot of eras, but there are some things I deeply, deeply want to discuss. One of which is actually in the Muscovy series. My son, many, many years ago, they had to do an original oral history project, and he actually chose a friend of ours who was Habsburg prince, who saw World War One as basically a family quarrel. He saw the history, the whole 20th century history from World War One to World War Two, from the point of view of his family and his extended family.
I think it was a family squabble.
And it was absolutely fascinating. But yes, I have from that I then actually started to look at different aspects of World War One, which have meant that I've actually come across archival material of the 1930s and World War Two, which I won't go into now because I'm not writing about it yet, and I am incredibly excited at actually having found it. It puts so much of the 1930s politics and World War II into a completely different perspective, and partly too it was because, again, I think the role of women was deliberately minimised. I can talk about actually part of it. Have you ever heard of La Dame Blanche, the white lady?
Yes, I have.
Yeah. And look, the common idea of resistance workers are sort of young men blowing up railway bridges. In World War One, the main resistance was run by women, predominantly grandmothers and young women. There were at least 3,500 of them, but only 6 were ever captured. And they knitted code on every occupied railway station. There would be a woman knitting. And their code would be coded into their knitting, so many twists, stitches, drops, etc. It was a complete code. And then the garments would then be passed on to British intelligence. The British thought they were running it, but when you actually read your history of the people concerned, they were really just using the British, and they certainly didn't let the British know who they were. They were simply too many links in intelligence and too strong links with Germany in Britain to do that. And yet the role of these incredible women has been entirely overlooked. And again, by 1942, every single British agent had either been killed or turned. In 1942, there were none left. And that was when they started using women again. And that statistic, I think, was so horrendous that they did need to wait until, I think it was about 2006, before that information was released. It was such an extraordinary failure on the part of British intelligence agencies that they simply could not let that be made public, just how deep and great their failure was. And also to the stupidity. In wartime, if you see an able-bodied bloke wandering around who's not in uniform, they're incredibly conspicuous. women that women aren't, particularly elderly women. And the Dan Rice, they specialised in old women. An old woman who blows up a railway bridge and then instead of actually running away and getting to cover, as a young man would, waits for the German soldiers to come, bursts into tears, sobs on the shoulder of the sergeant saying, it was terrible, I'm so scared. They're more likely to actually pat her hand and give her a nice cup of chicory coffee. Of course, she gets home okay, rather than check her for traces of explosives.
We'll remember the British attempts in World War I attempt to spy behind enemy lines at one point involved a one-eyed, one-armed man who couldn't speak German. So and somehow he got caught. He couldn't work out how that happened. I don't know how he was that conspicuous, really. But that says all you need to know about the statistics of British intelligence officers behind lines.
And there are elements of that in the Miss Lily series, which I've just started reading, and I just love it. Those elements of the women doing the work behind the scenes and using what power they had.
But, well, as the series progresses, Miss Lily series really is actually, it's a series about not so much the changing role of women, but the way that we women have actually perceived ourselves. Pre-World War I, the only way a woman had power was through a man, through actually having a salon, a husband, a father, etc. Women certainly were able to influence many things, but only through men. Interestingly, in World War II, if you read a lot of the memoirs, you actually see that the women had enormous power by then, acting as actually secretaries and assistants to men. The women were there. British intelligence, they even admitted that, in fact, it was the secretary in a flat in Mayfair who actually made most of the decisions. So women, by World War II, women were doing things in their own right. But then, I don't know if you know the author who wrote as James Tiptree Jr., though her real name was Alice Sheldon. She wrote under a male name, partly because she thought she wouldn't be published as a female, and also because she was working for the CIA and she wasn't supposed to write at all. But one of her stories was The Women Men Don't See. And the theme of her stories, and remember, she was writing this as a working CIA member, was that the real decisions and analysis were being done by women. Women running information sections, women running data analysis sections, women poring over photographs, actually working out the changes, women working in libraries, giving people the information that they needed. All of this was being done, but men simply didn't see them. They were invisible. And her work is so interesting because, again, this is still the 1950s and the 1960s. The women were there by then, but the work that they were doing, as with the brilliant, brilliant films and books actually about NASA now too, and the work that's coming out about the women codebreakers of World War II, the men were getting the credit for work that women were doing as well, and that was still happening in the 50s and the 60s. And look, it was certainly happening in academia. The research assistants in my time at the university and the few years afterwards would do the real work. In many cases, they would even write it. A paper I wrote as a third-year student was published almost word for word by my professor. And what strikes me as odd now is that neither of us thought that was odd. As a third year student, I was actually flattered that he thought my paper was worthwhile publishing, but it had his name on it, not mine.
Wow, it's crazy, isn't it?
That's the fascinating thing. We think it is crazy now, but back then it wasn't. And future generations are going to think of a lot of the things that we take for granted now are also crazy. We're not aware of our own cultural insanities.
Yeah, I think some of us are.
This is true.
Not enough people. Well, we just want to thank you so much, Jackie, for your time. I think we could have spoken to you all day. It's such an interesting chat. So rich and so complex, just as your books. And from an educator's perspective, I want to thank you for those rich and complex books that promote critical and creative thinking. And I think that's why they are taught in the classroom so much. Something I've noticed, you have an incredible number of books to be released in 2017-18, and I figure you must be an absolute insomniac, not asleep, or perhaps you're a vampire, I'm not sure.
No, in fact, if I don't get my 8 or 9 hours sleep, I'm not productive.
An 8 or 9 hours sleep, that's
incredible.
I
deeply, deeply need my sleep to be able to work. But remember, the books coming out next year were written over a 10 or 12 year period, and they were researched over about a 30 year period. So they're this sort of, yes, it looks as though I've suddenly written a lot of books, but my books are written gradually. My process is to think about a book for at least 3 years, if not a decade, to draft it out. And then it's more a thing of actually rewriting, but actually putting in richer layers. And it's often, I've often actually written 2 or 3 versions of it before I actually realise what themes I'm writing about. And then I actually sharpen the themes as well. So it's not so much redrafting as actually re-layering after layer after layer after layer that goes into the book.
And I'm going to make every single student I teach writing as an English teacher to hear that sometimes stories take 3 years or decades to create, not for 20 minutes in class.
Well, I think that's actually one of the necessities, the tragedies of teaching writing in class, is that the first idea you get is probably a cliche. It's probably based on something you've seen or something you've read. Humans have to think in cliches. If every time we crossed a road, we had to reevaluate again actually what a car is, what it could do when hitting human flesh, etc., we have to think in cliches. Otherwise, we'd spend our entire lives acting a bit like actually a tortoise or a wombat, thinking for a long period of time if something new happens. We can't do that. We don't do that. So it does mean that if you're not given much time to think and develop a story, the chances are it's probably going to be a cliche. Now, the way for kids to get over that, and I think kids who really love writing do that, is that off their own bat, for their own joy and fulfilment, they've been thinking about stories, so they've got some ideas already ready that they can actually write down when they need to write something in class. But for those kids who haven't, being given 20 minutes to write something is a very good way of actually getting shallow thinking and cliches. One of the things I do in workshops, whether it's with kids or adults, is to take a cliche and then develop it to show how you can actually break narrative expectation. For example, you're watching a TV series. It opens with a middle-aged woman early in the morning. She's taking her Labrador for a walk down by the mist, and there are the reeds, and here's the mist rising, etc., etc. And the dog suddenly goes woof, 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 and races to the edge of the lake. What is going to happen next? And, of course, the dog is going to find a body. No middle-aged woman can go for a walk in the morning without finding a body. If a soldier says, my wife has had the baby 2 days ago, okay, 30 seconds is going to be short. Or if he says, after the war, I'm going to take over my uncle's vineyard and make the best wine in, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, 30 seconds later is going to be short. One of the great things with kids is, okay, let's take a cliche, whether it's a vampire, zombie, or anything like that. Let's take the cliche and see how we can develop it to make it original. Mm. And once you've done that for about 20 minutes, this is a group exercise, they're so enthusiastic. They suddenly realise the potential of imagination and creativity, and it's almost impossible to stop them writing. The number of teachers have actually come back after that and said, "Look, we couldn't give them the math lesson. They just desperately wanted to keep writing their stories." Once you give kids the taste of creating, it becomes addictive. And of course, creating is not just writing stories. This is something politicians need to learn when they do school funding and library funding, etc. When someone has an idea for an invention, an idea of the nature of the universe, when they go into medical research, etc., as Einstein said, it's not so much intelligence, it's imagination, it's creativity, it's being able to go beyond the cliche and think about something new. So when you are training brains in your English lessons or your history lessons, you're not necessarily creating writers, you're not necessarily creating historians, but you are training creators. Mm-hmm. And whether their idea of creation is going to let us mine the asteroids or develop new medicines or a whole range of other things, this is what you're doing. You are creating creators.
And that's some wonderful advice for the classroom. Thank you so much, Jackie, for your time, your wealth of knowledge and your passion for creating readers. I really appreciate it. I hope educators and readers get a lot out of this podcast. And once again, we know we're taking time out of your Saturday. So we thank you so much. It's been absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you very much, Jackie.
No, absolute pleasure.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.